And our special guest this hour, Seth Zostak from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And this hour, as we chat with him, we'll also take your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Seth Zostak with us. Seth, Hillary Clinton's aide, John Podesta, has been talking about UFOs recently. And a lot of people think that if she gets elected, she's going to make an effort to try to disclose or find out what's going on. I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, you know, her husband, the former president, actually did try and find out, at least he said he did, find out what was really, you know, known about aliens at Area 51. And he was asked, you know, what he learned, and he said, well, not much. You know, they didn't say they had any aliens there. Now, you know, maybe Hillary will try that again, make another initiative to try and learn what's at Area 51. But I look at it as a kind of a no-win situation. I mean, I have to say, given that I'm skeptical about all this, that it seems like a pretty weak argument to say that we're being visited, the aliens are here, and the good proof is somewhere in the South Nevada desert stacked up there. And until we get information about that, we won't be able to prove it any other way. That sounds weak to me. But here's the deal. If they come back and they say, you know, aliens are there, well, that would be really remarkable. But if they come back and say there are no aliens here, just, you know, high-performance aircraft, I don't think that this issue suddenly goes away and the people who think the government is keeping secrets are suddenly going to say, okay, well, they're not keeping secrets.
That's right. That's right. People are seeing something, Seth, whatever it might be.
Well, it's true. But, you know, the people that I've talked to, and I have to admit it's very few, but I know at least one person who's worked there. And, you know, she saw a lot of aircraft.
You have a fun job, my friend.
Well, it, you know, it always looks fun from the other side, I guess.
You're still doing the radio show?
We are, yes. Big Picture Science. Yes.
Is that how do people find it?
Well, Big Picture Science, you know, it's on a bunch of stations, but mostly NPR stations. But you can just Google Big Picture Science or just go to bigpicturescience.org.
Okay, that's great. That's great. Let's take some calls for you this hour. We'll go to Jack in Alberta, Canada to get things started. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on with Seth Zostak.
Good morning, George and Seth.
Hi.
I'm really enjoying the program this evening.
Thank you, Jack.
Hey, I got a question for you, Seth. Boy, a number of years ago now, SETI used to have a program, for lack of a better term, whereby they were asking the general public to help use some of our computing power to do your guys' searching.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
I do, Jack.
Okay. I'm wondering.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I did that for a long time with a number of my computers, and I'm just wondering if that program is still going. I haven't done it for a long time, and if it either way, was it any kind? Did you have any kind of success with that?
Well, first off, I have to tell you, Jack, that it's not our program.
It's another something.
Yes,
that sounds like SETI.
The University of California, Berkeley SETI program that set that up. They could do that because the way they take data, it's all right if the data are looked at, analyzed, if you will, weeks or even months after the data are taken. The way we do it at the SETI Institute with our Allen Telescope Array is we check out any possible signals right away, within minutes, okay? Well, you can see that there are, you know, advantages and disadvantages, and by checking it out right away, you might find something that's interesting and keep looking at it forever. Whereas if you check a couple of weeks later, you might not be able to do that. On the other hand, by using something like SETI at home, you get to, you know, do many more sorts of analyses of the data. But SETI at home, which is the program you're talking about, is still out there. You can still use it, and it's being used to reduce data that the University of California, Berkeley people are taking now.
Amazing what a group of computers can do when they're all tied up together, Seth.
Absolutely. It's called the biggest, it's referred to as the biggest computer in the world in a sense, because, you know, in terms of computations per second, you've got millions, literally millions of machines that are, you know, cranking away. So for certain kinds of problems, not just, you know, SETI problems, but also things like folding proteins, you know, learning something about biology. If you get this huge compute power, you know, available to you, then you can do certain classes of problems very much quicker.
Would you say that knowledge in the universe, assuming it's all out there, progresses at about the same pace So where we are today as a species, Seth, would be the same someplace else, given the same time period?
Well, I think that it's unlikely that it would be the same. I mean, if you go to the movies, right, see, your typical alien film, the aliens have come to Earth usually to take out Los Angeles. You know, and from the point of view of Northern California, most people here would say, okay, well, that's all right. But the facts are that that kind of assumes that they're at the sort of the same level we are, because we can always take them on and win, right? And we couldn't do that if they were really, you know, 100,000 years more advanced than we are. And in reality, the chances that any two societies are at exactly the same point in their development is pretty unlikely. I mean, it's just like going out onto the streets and grabbing the first person you see and say, hey, when was your birthday? And they have the same month, day, and year, and maybe even hour as you. I mean, it could happen, but it's pretty unlikely.
Let's go to Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Blair, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George and Mr. Seth Shostak. I have fond memories of Lowell Observatory up here in Flagstaff, 30 miles north of us, laying outside at 1 in the morning outside the observatory that discovered the planet Pluto in 1930, watching the Leonid meteor showers. Ah, those are great memories. And as an astronomer, I've always wondered how open SETI is to what you said to George earlier, new and puzzling comes from nature, in regard to, say, upgrade, adjust your receivers from radio to other incoming frequencies from space. Thanks, George.
Okay, Blair, thank you.
Okay, Blair. Well, of course we're open. I mean, you know, scientists are hardly perfect, but they're usually open to new ideas because, after all, that's their living, really. But, you know, when you say, okay, let's upgrade our receiving equipment from radio to other frequencies, well, in a sense, we do that because we do have a project. There are several projects around the world to look for flashing lights in the sky, you know, laser lights. So that's a different frequency, if you will. But if you say, well, what about, you know, I don't know, hyperdimensional physics or something like that, you are subspace communication like they have in Star Trek, it's easy enough to use those words. But if you don't have any science behind it, if you don't have any physics, if you can't buy a textbook on subspace communication, then it's very hard to build any equipment that would use it because you don't know what it is. So, you know, you're kind of stuck with the physics you have.
I still have a difficult time, Seth, understanding the Big Bang, even trying to comprehend how something could bang from almost nothing. I just can't get it.
Well, George, you're not the only one that doesn't get it. If you do get it, by the way, you should book a flight to Stockholm and
and pick up that prize. Yeah. I mean, it's even in your case, you know, you're an astronomer, you're a scientist. It's weird, isn't it?
Well, it is strange. I mean, it seems, at least, you know, some physicists will tell you that you can't just, you know, have nothingness, that nothingness will always produce something. That's just seems to be the physics of the cosmos. And that's a very subtle idea that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But when it comes to cosmology, you know, look, we're critters that evolved on the savanna. We're really good at hunting down dinner on a savanna. We're not very good about contemplating how a universe might begin.
We have now Andrew in Roanoke, Virginia on the line. Andrew, thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
Great.
My question sort of piggybacks on the last question that you just asked from the previous caller. You know, I'm listening to this program right now on a cellular network because my area, I don't get it on the radio here. You know, I watch TV. I watch internet TV. I'm at home on Netflix and, you know, various other services. It comes in through a cable underground. So my question is, you know, this era of radio transmission, FM transmission, UHF, VHF transmission, is it coming to an end here on Earth? And is it possible that, you know, on some other, you know, planet somewhere that, you know, they had their brief prehistory of regular old air radio transmission, but that is over now as well? I'll just listen to your comments off the air here.
Huh. Okay. Well, Andrew,
It's over for all of us.
Yeah, that's a good question. I was going to say George might want to answer this question. Well, it's good to hear from a fellow Virginian, too, Andrew. I've got to say that. But, you know, a lot of people have said kind of what you're saying, that the aliens won't be broadcasting any signals into space because they will have gone beyond what's called terrestrial broadcast. They won't have those big antennas on the hills outside of town belching out the kilowatts and that sort of thing. But you know what? Broadcast, it may not be the way you're going to listen to radio or watch TV in your home or surf the internet. It's not the way you do it now, probably. But it's pretty good if you're in your car and you want to listen to coast to coast. It's pretty good to have some transmitters somewhere. And the other thing that it's good to have transmitters for are radar, right? The strongest signals coming from Earth are actually not, you know, radio and TV. They're radar. And if you're landing in Chicago in a storm, you probably really want that radar to be turned on. Or if you're, you know, worried about long-period comets that might come from the very outer fringes of the solar system and ruin your whole day by hitting the Earth, you might want some pretty powerful radars. Nobody can say what the aliens are using radio for, but it's such a good way of sending bits around or learning about the universe. Yeah, I think even if they're 100,000 years more advanced than we are, they will still use radio for something.
Do you find that technology is getting so good that this is making everybody's job, like yours, easier?
Well, I don't know whether it makes it easier or harder. Sometimes I think it makes it harder. I mean, my job consists of answering email, it seems to me, some days. So I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Technology allows you to do things, however, that you couldn't do before. And certainly in the case of SETI, it's very important, because otherwise we would still be doing the same experiments that Frank Drake did half a century ago. Thanks to the improvements in technology, we can, you know, scan star systems much more quickly, much more sensitivity, and over a wide range of the radio dial. You know, I mean, that's just technology, and that's what gives me hope that we may find something while I'm still alive.
How many people working at SETI, Seth?
Well, at the SETI Institute, the number of people that are employed there is, well, in terms of the scientific staff, it's about maybe 80 PhD scientists, but most of them are not actually doing SETI. They're doing what's called astrobiology. So they're interested in life in space, but they're studying, for example, the situation on Mars. There might be bacteria under the surface of Mars, or some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. There are half dozen moons out there that might conceivably be harboring life. Again, life you'll need a microscope to see, but, you know, biology is biology.
What's the latest with that super telescope in Hawaii? Are they building it, or there were protesters there for a while?
Yeah, I lost track of that story. I don't know. It's kind of an awkward story because, on the one hand, you know, they're trying to build a telescope that would really tell us a whole lot that's new about the universe and maybe answer some of these tricky questions that come up in this show and elsewhere. And on the other hand, you've got the native culture that thinks that mountain has enough telescopes on it. But I haven't followed the story recently, so I don't know whether they're... I don't think they've started construction yet, but that's my guess.
Let's go to River City, California. ARL is with us. Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. Sure. The vast distances that have to be bridged to reach some space-faring, longer life of civilization are not likely to be reached with modern-day rocketry. And so since there are growing evidence that the distances have been bridged, my question is, where are the welcoming committees on this planet?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I mean, what are you suggesting? Should we have big signs, you know, welcome to Earth kind of thing? Or, I mean, there are a lot of people, in fact, something like one-third of all people, who think that we are being visited, and as far as I can tell, they haven't been hostile to the aliens.
There's some great theories, too, Seth. Are you familiar with the work of the late Zachariah Sitchin?
Well, somewhat.
He theorized, based on looking at Sumerian Sanskrits, that in tablets, that we were visited from a planet in the solar system called Nibiru, Planet X, for example, and that they came and genetically altered us, and that the Bible makes reference to it all, but talks about it in terms of God and angels when it was really them who did this.
Well,
interesting theory.
Yeah. You know, George, there are two aspects of that idea that you could at least look at from the standpoint of science. One is Nibiru. Is there a Nibiru? And, of course, a big story that's been in the media for the past couple of months is the possibility of another planet out there, right? This was announced by two guys at Caltech.
Yeah.
And
is that what they call Planet Nine?
Yes, they call it Planet Nine.
The killer planet, right?
Well, I don't know that you'd call it a killer planet, although it would probably kill you if you went there because it would be really cold. but it's not likely to be. It's not going to be on an orbit that brings it anywhere close to us. It stays out there. It's like Pluto. You can worry about Pluto, but Pluto's not going to, you know, interfere with your lifestyle because it's out there and it's staying out there. And the same with this planet. But it might be big. It might be big, bigger than the Earth, actually. It might be, you know, maybe two, maybe up to three times the diameter of the Earth. Now, we haven't seen it yet, but there's this indirect evidence that's pretty good that suggests it's out there. In fact, some people say maybe there's more than one. But it shouldn't be confused with this Nibiru idea, which envisions some planet maybe the same size or so, but that routinely, every so many thousand years, comes to the inner solar system.
Yep.
And, you know, bugs us.
3,600 years, they say.
Yeah, well, that's a long time for a planet. But, you know, that there's no evidence for that. So this is not Nibiru. So that's point one. The other thing is they've genetically modified us. And I wouldn't mind a little bit of genetic modification, actually. But if you look at our genome, right, it's 98.5% the same as for chimps. Right? So if they modified it, they didn't modify very much. They didn't. You know, I don't know what to say about that, but you would think that if you sequence the human genome and you know, you can tell what's been changed over our predecessors, and it isn't a whole lot. It is the difference between us and them, of course, but, you know, I think that that's a kind of a dicey theory, frankly.
If this planet is out there and does come around every 3,600 years, would the computer models be able to, by using that 3,600-year model, would they be able to pinpoint where it could be?
Well, if it's every 3,600 years, that means it isn't terribly far out there, and at least in most parts of its orbit, you could just see it, right?
We should be able to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously not with your eyes, unless it's very close, but you could see it with telescopes, and we don't see it. But more than that, if something every 3,600 years, right, 3,600 years sounds like a long time, but in the history of this solar system, that's what? That's 1 million. I mean, it's been around a million times. Did I get that right? Yeah, I think I got that right. So it's done this a million times. It's come to the inner solar system. Well, anything that has zipped through, you know, the orbits of Mars and Earth and Venus or whatever, a million times will have pulled the planets into funny positions. It will have done something. And we don't see that. The planets are very sedate, the inner planets.
How do you explain the Dogon tribe in New Guinea that talked about a binary star system in the star system of Sirius when we didn't find it until, God, years later?
Well, I can't say that I personally visited the Dogons, but I have to say that I did read an article that pointed out that, the argument is that they talked to Europeans about a companion star, and by the way, more than half of stars have companion stars.
Yeah.
But that this was a white dwarf, which is very hard to see. They could certainly not have seen it without telescopes. And yet they seem to know about it. But at least one article I read suggested that actually they were told about it by some other Europeans that had visited them earlier. So that's a story I heard, but take it for what it's worth.
Seth, we're coming back with final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're going to come back in a moment with Seth Shostak, and we're going to take final phone calls as we talk about search for extraterrestrial intelligence, a subject that I absolutely love. Welcome back, Seth Shostak with us. Seth, at what age did this all capture you, looking at the stars and the planets?
Yeah, well, I usually answer at the age of 8 because I do recall opening up an atlas in my parents' house. I guess it was my house, too, now I think about it. And, there was a diagram in the back of the solar system, and I had never seen anything like that, and I asked my mom. But she tells me I was afraid of the stars when I was younger than that, so who knows?
I love it. And, of course, you're a noted author, too. One of your books, Confessions of an Alien Hunter.
Yes, indeed. Well, I do a lot of writing. Yeah, I do.
When you go out, You don't go out a lot, but when you go out and people find out what you do, do they go crazy?
Well, they don't go crazy. Actually, you know, George, at parties, and as you note, I don't go to a whole lot of parties, but people will ask, you know, what I do for a living, and I usually just you know, make up something up, just a wait guesser at the amusement park or something like that.
Yeah.
But at some point, they recognize that I'm joshing with them, and they say, no, really? And I say, well, I look for aliens. And they just assume that's another joke. So they don't go crazy.
They realize joke on top of a joke, right?
Yeah, that's what they're figuring, yeah.
All right, let's go back to the calls. First-time caller Rick is in Los Molinos, California. Rick, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George and Seth.
Hi.
I just have a little story for you.
Sure.
When I was a kid in high school back in the early 1970s, I had an uncle who enjoyed all this stuff, and we were watching a program that was being narrated by Carl Sagan, and it was called Chariots of the Gods. And they happened to show those plaques that they had put on the Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 space probes.
Right.
And the sign shop I was working in, I looked at that and I said, hey, we made those. And my uncle looked at me and said, yeah, sure, kid. You know, so when I went back to work, we made a third plaque. And I wrapped it up and gave it to him for his birthday. So needless to say, I still have the plaque.
How cool is that?
So, an unusual item for you.
It sure is. I love that story.
I got to say, actually, when it comes to the Pioneer plaques, my understanding was that, you know, talking to the NASA guys, was that they were engraved by a bowling trophy shop here on the peninsula south of San Francisco. And I they went up to that shop. It's, you know, like a 20-minute drive from where I live. And there it was. They had a copy. They had a third plaque. Maybe it was the fourth plaque. But they had it in the window. And I talked to the guy, and he said, yeah, they just, you know, NASA just asked us to engrave this thing.
What do you think the significance of that plaque was, Seth,
well,
on those probes?
You know, people talk about time capsules or how, you know, our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids will ever know about what we did and, you know, will there be anything left of us and so forth and so on. You can talk about burying things in the ground with newspapers and films and stuff like that, but the items that will survive the longest that say anything about Homo sapiens are things like that plaque or the things that we put on the moon. Those will last a long time.
Seth, if we happen to survive 10,000 years into the future, 10,000 years, what do you think it's going to look like? And what kind of technology could we possess?
Well, I don't know, George. I mean, you could have asked somebody, you know, 10,000 years ago, some guy, you know, just figuring out how to do agriculture and grow food, right? So
somebody was building the pyramids or
well,
something.
Well, not 10,000 years ago. In fact, that's more recent. So, you know, 10,000 years ago, we were sort of hunter-gatherers turning into farmers, and you'd ask them, hey, what do you think it's going to be like in the year 2016? And they'd probably tell you stories, but I don't think any of them would be very accurate. I don't know. I think that the most important thing that's happening in this century, we occasionally talk about it, is the invention of artificial intelligence, and that certainly has the capability
yeah.
of changing everything.
That sure could. They're talking about warfare with robots and everything now.
Yeah, I think we're going to get away from fighting war with soft, squishy soldiers. We're just going to do it with machines.
Just turn them loose. Make more. Chinese technology, they'll have like 100,000 drones flying all over the place.
Jeez. I like your optimism.
Let's go to Nancy in San Jose, California, hockey town. Hey, Nancy, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Good evening to the two of you.
Hi.
I'm here to share with you that the orange glowing balls that they're seeing everywhere around the world, they are our space brothers.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Tell me more, and how do you know that?
I'm a Native American Indian, and my father is full-blooded, and when he was passing away, I was taking care of him, and he would tell me what he would see, and what he told me was that there were spacemen that were coming for him.
Hmm.
Well, Nancy, I don't know what to say to that. I mean, you know, it's all I can say is that
I would have thought they were plasma balls.
Yeah, there are a lot of other possible explanations for these sorts of things, and from the standpoint of, you know, science, anyhow. you know, stories, witness testimony, that sort of thing, is just, you know, very poor evidence, really, for something that you wish to be true. If you say, look, you know, I think there's a big spot on Jupiter, and because my grandfather told me there was one, that's one thing, but nobody's going to believe you until you put a telescope to work and actually see it.
The Federation. I keep thinking about Star Trek and what it could be like in the future if everybody connects. The universe probably would do that, wouldn't it? A grouping of, you know, intelligent life forms?
Well, they might. I mean, that sounds like the Mos Eisley scene in Star Wars where everybody sits around and, you know, shares a beer and the music.
Yeah.
But, of course, that kind of presupposes that they're all more or less on the same level, right? I don't think that, if you will, Neanderthals would find it very interesting to go to a jazz bar with us. They probably wouldn't like the food or the music. So if you have, you know, extraterrestrials at all levels of development, some are way behind us, some are way ahead of us, the idea that we would socialize or communicate in some sort of giant, you know, internet doesn't sound very plausible. But in any case, you can say that the universe has kind of conspired against that by making sure that, you know, information can't go any faster than the speed of light, so it just takes too long to send a text to the Klingons.
I was going to sing a Neanderthal song for you, Seth, but it's all grunts, so I'm going to pass on that. Gary in Ohio, welcome to the show. Hi, Gary.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hey, Seth, pleasure to talk to you. I've been a big fan since I first started seeing you on the Science Channel, Discovery Channel shows. You were really fluent in how you explain things.
Well, thank you very much, Gary. I'll tell my mom.
Okay. My question was, I'm from Circleville, Ohio. It's a small town about 20 miles so south of Columbus. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing about, back in the 70s, a research group at Ohio State discovered for a brief time what they called the wow signal.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could give some background on that, why they found it so exciting, and if, well, if they've ever got a signal like that before again. And I'll listen to you off the...
Okay, thank you, Gary. The wow signal.
The wow signal, Gary. Yeah, it's probably the most famous signal ever picked up in a SETI experiment. Very briefly, what happened was that in the 1970s, the Ohio State Radio Observatory was using its antenna, which was called the Big Ear. Big Ear. And it was big. It was more than a football field long.
That's big.
Yeah, it was big. Well, and now it's a golf course, actually. They got rid of the antenna and replaced it, which is a shame. But in any case, they weren't using it for astronomy anymore. They were using it for SETI. They just turned it on every day. The Earth rotates, and, you know, the sky would kind of sweep overhead, and they would just record what they found on a big, what was called a line printer. Anybody old enough to remember line printers? That's the way computer output usually was, you know, delivered to you on paper. And every morning, one of the astronomers would go in and look through all this paper and decide if there was anything interesting. And one morning, I think it was 1977, I believe, Jerry Amon was his name. He was working there at Ohio State. And he came in and he found a very big signal, which he wrote WOW next to with a magic marker. Okay. And that's how that signal became famous, because it was called WOW. If he just, you know, just noted it with a check mark or something, probably nobody would have heard of it, because there were hundreds of other signals that tended to be found in those days. But nobody knows what it was. It has been, I mean, it had the characteristics of an extraterrestrial signal. That's true. But on the other hand, that antenna was set up with a second receiver. And that receiver, about a minute later, automatically looked in the, you know, at the same spot and didn't find the signal. The signal went away. Now, since then, it's been looked at many times, mostly by a guy in Chicago by the name of Bob Gray, who has used telescopes around the world trying to find that signal again, and nobody, he just hasn't found it. We're even going to use the Allen Telescope Array with Bob to look again at the WOW signal. But if you don't find it a second time, unfortunately, Gary, all you can say is, well, it's a bit mysterious. It's like hearing rattling chains in your attic. It might be a ghost, but if you never hear them again and you go up there and you don't see anything, you know, you can't be sure.
And did the discoverer think that it might have been truly extraterrestrial?
Well, I don't really know what Jerry Amon thought about it. I do know that Bob Dixon, who was one of the radio astronomers there at Ohio State, you know, he said, well, you know, probably it was interference, but they couldn't prove what, I mean, they never tracked down what it was. So it's just one of those mysteries. And unfortunately, as I say, in science, if you observe a phenomenon only once, you're just not going to be able to sell it, if you will.
Well, all right, back we go to the call. Sid is in Abilene, Texas. Hey, Sid, good morning.
Hello.
Hi, Sid.
I was watching Netflix one night, and I was watching Unsealed Files on UFOs.
Okay.
And I seen them, they shot up a missile back in the 1960s, early 60s. They were shooting up these missiles, and something was, they was blowing up. They couldn't figure out why. And so they shot up one of them, and they had this guy follow it in a jet, and he was filming it. And he seen the missile explode, so he came back down to Earth, and they had the film, and they were going through it. And so they were showing it to him, and he said, yeah, he said, that's the way it did. And then they showed it to him again, and it showed that UFO come around that missile and shoot it three times. It shot it once, like with a ray gun.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like a fly. That's how fast it was. It was just flying all around it. It shot it three times, and it blew up.
Well, there are some interesting videos that are out there. The space shuttle videos, of course, as we talked about before. And sometimes pretty convincing, Mr. Shostak.
Well, yes, they are. Well, they've convinced a lot of people. It's true. I mean, Sid, it comes down to this. I mean, I don't know this particular incident, and I'm kind of amazed that the aliens are shooting down our aircraft, but maybe they were enemy aircraft. Who knows what they were shooting down? But, you know, we also shoot down drones and things like that as part of military tests. So, you know, here's a case where you say, I don't know what it was, but unless you have some physical evidence or something more than this pilot's report, you can't rule out that this was something that had absolutely nothing to do with extraterrestrials, but only with us. And, you know, in that case, you have to say, well, you know, I'm not going to go for the more radical explanation. I'm going to go for the more prosaic explanation.
Seth, what could the criteria be once a discovery, let's say, is discovered? What do you do? How do you announce it?
Well, for SETI, if we pick up a signal, what we do is we start, you know, following it. We don't move the antennas to some other star system. We just keep looking at the one that's producing the interesting signal, of course.
To see if it repeats and things like that?
Yeah, to make sure that it's still there. And we also do little simple things like moving the antenna a little bit away from the star system to make sure the signal goes away. Because if it's just interference coming from, you know, the local airport or something like that, it won't go away. It'll be there no matter where we point the antennas. So we just make sure that the signal's really coming from a spot on the sky. And if that goes on for a couple hours and, you know, it really looks good, then we would just call up somebody at another observatory and tell them to look at it too. I don't think you would believe it if you were the only ones to find it. You know, there's too much possibility that maybe it's just something in your equipment or who knows what. But if somebody, you know, half a continent away or in Europe or Australia or somebody, if they find it too, then I think you have a big story. You could have a press conference, but by the time you have the press conference, it'll be all over the papers.
Sure would. Let's go to Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning, Elaine. Go ahead.
Hi, George. This is Elaine.
Hi there.
Hi. I couldn't hear you for a minute.
That's okay. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you. I love you.
Thank you.
I love both you guys and everything, and I respect SETI, and I'm glad that they're there and everything. But I just have, I mean, also I want to say that I do believe that the extraterrestrials have been here for thousands of years and have genetically, and influenced us,
mm-hmm.
and all that stuff. But the main point I want to make is if they have been here for thousands and thousands of years, I think SETI is barking up the wrong tree, because they could certainly find some simple radio frequency that we're sending out, and they could certainly figure that out if they really wanted to communicate with us that way. They're not going to do it that way. It's obvious.
Well, that's a criticism, Seth, a critique of the SETI program, that the technology might be way beyond what you're using to listen. What do you think?
Well, I think that's possible. I mean, of course it's possible. It would be kind of hubris of the worst sort to say, no, they're going to use the technology we think they're going to use. I mean, you don't know. Of course you don't know. But on the other hand, if you go with that argument, you say, look, these guys might be 100,000, 100 million years more advanced than we are. They're not going to use the kind of technology that we use to communicate. Well, there may be physics that we don't know that allows them some other way to communicate. That's possible. But what are you going to do? You're going to say, all right, let's just stop listening because, doggone it, there's a possibility this is the wrong approach. You know, they just sit on your hands for, you know, a couple of thousand years and then decide, well, it was the right approach or it wasn't the right approach. But it's better if you're going to do exploration. You're sitting on a desert island. You have reason to think there may be some buried treasure there. You could sit around and wait for a backhoe to wash up on shore, or you could just take that shovel you got and start digging.
Seth, when you break the story that you've discovered something, you know where to go.
I do.
Seth Shostak from SETI. Up next, we're going to talk about parapsychology on Coast to Coast AM.